Okay, good morning, everyone. I think we'll start. Yep, already. We're third week into the series. So just for those who weren't here yet, we're just going through we're looking at the book by Michal Ashman, What Would Happen If You Weren't Afraid, her journey through therapy after her years of anxiety, even though she was very accomplished, and then finding Jewish wisdom and what it did for her and so on and so forth. So we'll just quickly review last week and then move in from there to today's discussion. So last week she talked about discovering the concept of a neshama, of a soul, as being the source and the driver of seeking meaning and purpose. She first discussed, we talked about her discussion on the failed journey of therapy and why it didn't work, because the type of therapy she was looking for was very much focused on the past trauma, which is real, but nevertheless stuck in the past, not sort of moving forward and being in the present. We talked about trauma being something that's really, very real. No one should ever minimize that, especially if it's major trauma. It can be something that's very, very damaging. But as we said last week, it's not a replacement for responsibility. So as painful as it might be, however painful it might be, we can never just park our problems there in the past and then not have to do anything about it. We can only move forward if we're prepared to put in the effort and take responsibility, whoever we are, to really try and give meaning and purpose to our lives and bring happiness to the present and the future. So in doing that, she discovered this concept of a neshama, the spark, as Viktor Frankl calls it, or soul as we call it in Jewish writings, which essentially is that part of us, that spiritual part of us, that is the driver of meaning and purpose. In a Jewish context, it's a divine spark, right? So we talked about the Vayipach Ba'apav, the verse that talks about how God blew into us, so to speak, a breath of life, which is why that part of us, that's the depth of the soul. The soul has different layers, as we discussed at the end last week, but the very essence of the soul is that divine spark which remains pure. It's the origin and foundation of resilience. It's the part of us which is never damaged, and it's the part of us which seeks meaning and connection, and that's where we always repair and rebuild from. We talked about that piece of Tanya which compares the soul to a flame. Two ideas. Number one, the flame is something that wants to always go up and be incorporated in its origin and its root and its source. And also the flickering of the flame is symbolic of the constant striving to grow, the constant need to always attach to something higher. But as she says at the end of that chapter, the soul needs discovery. It needs to be discovered. It needs to be connected to. The problem, of course, is that our soul is encased in our body, or better put, maybe encased in our bodily soul, the animalistic soul, as we call it, which is called klipa, and it often hides the expression and blocks the expression of the soul, and therefore we have to always reflect, and we have to stop once in a while and think and ask ourselves the question, how much are we connecting with our neshama? How much are we connecting with the soul? And that was brought out by the story that she talked about, the author of the Tanya being incarcerated, and the minister came to him and asked him the question about why God asked Adam, Ayeka, where are you? And explained it's an eternal question. And it's an eternal question we all have to ask ourselves once in a while, where are we? In other words, where are we up to in life? What's our purpose? What's our meaning? And are we connecting to the soul? Are we aware of the soul? Are we aware of what the soul can really do for us and what it drives us to do and what it all means? Okay. So today's discussion is the third chapter of the book, which looks at the concept of purpose. Okay, I want to just give a little bit of brief overview of what we're going to do so it's clear. So it looks at the idea of purpose, right? The idea of purpose. Because what happens is the soul, of course, is that spark which seeks purpose, seeks a life of a deeper life, a life to that is not just selfish and pleasure driven, but is there to look for something deeper, look for something more meaningful and something connected to a higher being or a higher purpose, higher calling. And therefore, once we connect, once, as we described last week, once we discover the soul, we then need to, okay, so what do we do with the soul? How am I going to satisfy the soul? How am I going to feed the soul, right? How am I going to give the soul expression in my life to bring that happiness and to bring that inner fulfillment and inner meaning? So the answer, of course, is purpose. Life of meaning and life of purpose. Right? So that purpose is driven by the soul. But what she does in this chapter, and I'm going to just break it up the way she does and have three different discussions, interconnected, of course, is she focuses on three different things. The first is the importance of purpose and the emptiness that often is created within a person when there's lack of purpose. That's very important. Okay. Secondly, she looks at a concept in order to move towards purpose and move away from egocentricity and selfishness. She talks about a concept of bittul. It's a Hasidic idea, which she studied when she started attending Hasidic courses. It's a very complex study, actually. I'm going to challenge the book a little bit when we get to it, because I don't think she actually gets to the depth of it the way it's really properly taught in Hasidic philosophy. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it still does a wonderful job at it. But literally means nullification or self-negation, but we'll see what that means, or humility or nothingness. But it can mean lots of things. We need to actually really understand what it really does mean. So that's a necessary step to move away from looking at a life empty of purpose towards a life filled with purpose. And then thirdly, we look at the concept of finding purpose and what that looks like. Okay. So let's start with this idea of purpose versus emptiness. So, as expected, she starts off the chapter by quoting Viktor Frankl, as we've done many, many times. And the story how he describes the terrible condition in the camps, and how every so often, as he describes in the book, it's a famous part of the book, someone would choose to take their own life running into the wire, the electric fences that surrounded the camps. And she quotes the book and the story that he tells. It says, one day one of Frankl's fellow prisoners told him that he was considering taking his own life. Frankl asked him, why do you want to kill yourself? So the man said, because I no longer have anything to expect from life. Right? Which was legitimate, actually, because... Do you want to turn that off, Robert?
No, it's beautiful.
Oh, that's good. Okay, we'll leave another few minutes until people really get freezing in there. Always part of shul politics, the level of air conditioning. Okay, so that's what the person told Frankl, which was very legitimate, that it was to be expected from someone who was enduring the type of suffering and torture and absolute dehumanizing of what happened in the camps, right? And that's why she says, under the circumstances, this man's answer might be considered understandable. What could life possibly hold for him? And now that the world, as he'd known it, had ceased to exist, not to mention the loss of family and home and so on and so forth. But Frankl didn't see it that way. He looked at his friend and told him honestly. This is a powerful line. He says, it might be the case that you have nothing to expect from life. But isn't it conceivable that life expects something from you?
And you was going to say that.
Yeah, right. Which is fascinating, and as much of Frankl's writings, it's, you know, I think his Jewish soul was really on fire, even though he wasn't necessarily so conscious of it. But this story, this answer is so in line with Jewish thought. There's a story of the first Chabad Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe, the author of Tani that she quotes a lot, right? That someone came to him for what's called in the Hasidic tradition the Yechidut, which is a private audience, and traditionally, when Hasidim or anyone would go into a tzaddik or a rebbe for yichidut, they write on a piece of paper what the requests are, and very often the requests involve personal blessings. You know, it could be blessing for health, blessings for parnasah, for livelihood, for sustenance, whatever, advice, blessing, lots of things, right? And one time, a particular chassid, a particular follower came, had traveled from a different shtetl to the Alter Rebbe, and he went into Yechidut, and he had a long shopping list. Right? He said to Rabbi, listen, I got lots of problems. And he spoke in Yiddish. He says, Ich daf, I need this. I need more parnassa. I need to marry off my daughter. I need to pay for the wedding. I don't know. I've been feeling so worse lately. I need better health. My niece needs whatever. He had a long list of Ich daf, I need. So the Alter Rebbe looked at him with very, this is how the story goes. The Alter Rebbe looked at him with very, very penetrating eyes. As the Alter Rebbe would, apparently, and he answered him in a sing-song. The Alter Rebbe was known to like answer sometimes in like a singing sort of voice. And so I don't know what the song was, so I won't sing it, but he said to him as follows. He said in Yiddish, I'll say it in Yiddish just because it's so beautiful, but I'll translate it. He says, Du sagst, which means you say, als was du darfst, everything that you need. Aber du sagst nicht, but you don't say, zu was mir darf dir, why we need you. The story goes, the person actually really took it to heart. He was a devout chassid, and he actually fainted. But he came to very quickly, and he asked Alter Rebbe for a direction and inspiration on how he should live his life. And now, it needs to be understood this, right? And this is really what Frankl was telling this person in a different way. It's a whole mindset shift. It's like a whole about, like, I'm here for a reason. The world needs me, or purpose needs me. God, not needs, but God wants me, or matters to me, wants me. He sends me on a certain mission, right? Rather than, what is it I want? Now, the story needs to be understood a little bit, because some of our needs are really good. Is it illegitimate to want to have a parnassah, to have a livelihood? It's not, right? Not only that, I mean, it's an interesting story, going back to the story of the Alter Rebbe. I mean, people came all the time to ask for blessings for what they need. Not only him, all the tzaddikim, all rebbes. I mean, that's what you do. That was part of the audiences. Either you'd ask for advice on how you serve God better, or you'd ask for things that you need, right? So, what was the problem with that particular chassid? And is it, I mean, the truth is, putting aside going to a great person to ask for blessing, how about our prayers? If you look at the daily prayers, and you look at the main part of our daily prayers, which is the Amidah. And the Amidah is known as the highest rung, it's the highest level of daily prayer, where we stand face to face to God, so to speak, right? The way the Amidah, it's always, you know, you stand with your feet together. Why do you stand with your feet together? Because Kabbalistically, the daily prayer is like a ladder where you climb it slowly. And then you get to the highest level and you say the Amidah. And the Amidah is always taught to us to be an experience where you stand, as the Talmud puts it, ka'avda kamei mara, which means like a servant before his master, in total surrender. And you're standing face to face to God and you're talking to him, and it's a real conversation. And then you look at the content of the Amidah, it's the same shopping list, right? Refa'einu, can we have health? Barech aleinu, can you give us sustenance? Right? Can you see our affliction? Look at our suffering. That's individual prayers. Then we look at communal prayers. There's anti-Semitism. Could you get rid of that? You know, can we have a rebuilt Jerusalem? And so on and so forth. Yeah, of course, the Amidah starts with three introductory blessings of praising God. It ends with three concluding blessings of thanking God, gratitude. All good, but the crux of the Amidah, or as Maimonides puts it, the essence of tefillah, the essence of prayer halachically, is what we call in Hebrew, bakashat zrachav, to ask for your needs. Right? To ask for what you really need. So what's the problem? But the answer is like this, and it's actually embedded in a beautiful, beautiful explanation that the Lubavitcher Rebbe once gave on a story that we read on, I might have mentioned before around Rosh Hashanah time, but it's a passage that we read on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, where there was a great righteous woman called Hannah. She was the mother of the prophet Samuel, and she was childless, and she wanted children, and it was a time of the Mishkan Shiloh. It wasn't the temple yet, but it was the pre-temple temple, which was standing in the city of Shiloh. And she would come each year with her husband, and it was all story. Her husband had two wives, Penina and Hannah. Penina tormented her and had lots of children and didn't treat her nicely. And she would come and pour out her heart in front of God. And one Rosh Hashanah she came, and she went into the sanctuary where the Holy of Holies was close by, a very holy spot, and she poured out her heart to God, and she cried, and she spoke to God like you speak to a father, and she asked for a child. But what she did was, she spoke very quietly, she whispered, which incidentally is where the halachic source of saying the Amidah quietly comes from, right? Comes from Chana. But at the time, the high priest, a great holy man known as Eli HaKohen, was sitting in his chair, and he was observing her prayer. And as the simple literal meaning of the story goes, he suspected her of being drunk. That's what she looked like. He wasn't, at that time, people didn't pray like that quietly, and she was obviously very emotional, and she looked like someone who was intoxicated. So he called her over afterwards and said to her, why are you drunk? Hasiri yeinechem alayich, remove your wine from you. It's not appropriate what you're doing. Why are you standing here and praying in this intoxicated context? So Hannah turns to him and she says, lo adoni, no my master, I'm not drunk. I'll say the Hebrew because it's important to the discussion. I'm pouring out my heart before God. And he listened to her, he agreed to her, and he said, go home, you'll be blessed with a child. And she was, and that was Samuel the prophet. Now, the obvious question on the story, as the Rebbe put it, is, Eli HaKohen was no was no stupid person. He was a great sage. He was the high priest. Surely he can tell the difference between a drunk woman and a praying woman. I mean, it's not that hard, right? And also, if there's two options, maybe she's emotionally upset. Maybe she's really praying. And if you've got two options how to judge someone, don't we always talk about judging people favorably? Like, why did he jump to the conclusion that she was drunk? Right? And he gave a very fascinating, deep explanation. He says, no, he never is suspected of being intoxicated with alcohol. Drunk can mean anything that's in excess, right? And this is the conversation. And from this conversation, we learn a very important thing, and it really goes to the heart of this idea. He knew exactly what she was doing. But at the end of the day, what she was doing was focusing on her need excessively. So he thought, this was his thought process, there's an aspect of that that is not right. At the end of the day, she's in a holier spot at that time of divine presence. It's a place where you really need to be focused on God, not so much yourself, even if your personal need is a good need. So he said. So he suspected her of being drunk, not drunk in the alcohol sense, drunk in excessive personal focus, excessive personal need. And he confronted her on that. To which she answered, "Lo Adoni, no, I'm not drunk. I'm pouring out my heart to God." What does that mean? She wasn't just saying I was praying to God. It was obviously praying to God. She wasn't praying to anyone else in Shiloh, right? She was saying something different. She was saying, I'm praying to God for God. In other words, I'm asking for personal needs, but it's in the context of the foundation of my life. The foundation of my life is not my personal life. It's not my personal needs. It's not pursuit of pleasure. It's not my personal success. My foundation of life is to bring godliness into the world, to live a higher life, to do good. Good for others, good for my soul, good for what God wants me here for. I need a child for that. That's part of the process. I need a home to live in. I need resources. In other words, there's two ways of asking for your needs. Asking for your needs is nothing wrong. It's the basis of prayer. We are commanded, not just encouraged, we are commanded to ask for our needs. That's part of what prayer is. But it depends what the context is. Where's the starting point? If the starting point is, I need, because I just need to live a life of having success, material success, or good image, family success, or pleasure success, whatever the case is, or is my starting point purpose? And therefore, in order to achieve that purpose, I turn to God and say, well, I want to achieve that purpose, but the resources are important. I can only be kind to others if I have the resources to be kind. I can only help people if I have the emotional, intellectual, or physical, material resources to be able to help people, or to be able to live properly with meaning and purpose. I can only be hospitable if I have a house. I can only raise others and inspire others if I have children, have a family, and so on and so forth, right? And he accepted that. The Rebbe once gave this explanation. It was on the yahrzeit of his mother. He gave this sort of, he dedicated this explanation to the passing of his mother. And it was between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Because he asked this question, and he says this question becomes even more emphasized on Rosh Hashanah, where we have two contradictory themes running through the prayers. On the one hand, if you look at the prayers of Rosh Hashanah, you'll see it's all about crowning God as king and surrendering to his authority and so on and so forth. And then we come with our huge, long shopping list of all the things that we need for the coming year. Right? So he says, how do those two things go together? And he says, they do. It's our job to make them come together. It's our job to make sure that they align. That our starting point is not being empty. Right? Our starting point is meaning. And it's in that context that we come and we try. I mean, we don't always do it right because, you know, we have an ego too, but we try at least to align those requests and to say that I'm trying to ask them because I'm trying to ask for those needs and to use them for a good purpose. And I think that goes back to the story of the Alter Rebbe when he told that Chassid, you're saying, I need, but what do we need you for? He wasn't saying that it's inappropriate to ask for those things, but he detected a certain loss of focus there, detecting that he was too absorbed in the things that he needed and he'd forgotten why he needs it. So that's what it is. It's about, of course we have needs, and those needs are appropriate, as long as they're appropriate needs, of course, right? But it's not just what we need, it's why we need them, and what the starting point is. So, she says, going back to the book, She says that was something that really awakened her, because she says, in my desperation to fix myself, you know, previous years, I, like many others, had become so concerned with what I needed to get out of life that I'd forgotten about what I had to give. Right? I hadn't realized that just as I had a unique soul inside me, I also had a unique purpose. Where modern culture says, how can I be fulfilled? Jewish wisdom asks, what am I here to do? Now, obviously, when you answer the question, what am I here to do, it brings real fulfillment, right? That's the purpose here. That's the whole point here. A life of meaning and purpose brings ultimate fulfillment. So she describes different things that used to happen in her career, in her professional life, and so on and so forth. And then she says, she realizes that when you don't seek meaning, you don't seek purpose, what that creates is a hole of emptiness, which Viktor Frankl talks about, right? So Frankl calls this emptiness, she says, the existential vacuum. He describes the internal void that comes about when you cannot clarify what is truly meaningful to you. This void of meaninglessness causes anxiety, sadness, and a lack of purpose. Right? He explains that these days no instinct tells you what you need to do and no tradition tells you what you ought to do. Sometimes you don't even know what you wish to do. Instead, you end up doing what other people do or what other people tell you to do. Right? We feel lost, even when we are living what looks like a beautiful life, with financial stability, a good job, surrounded by people who love us, we still feel an existential vacuum. And she explains what that is, or he explains what it is. He says it's a crisis in which people cannot find meaning and purpose in life. It's a gut-wrenching feeling that makes you feel purposeless, as if deep inside you know there's more you should be doing, but don't know what it is. And that feeling that life is meaningless, this is the point, often results in you seeking immediate satisfaction, something that will fill up the emptiness inside, anything to avoid that terrible void, which of course it doesn't do, right? This is the problem. This is what Viktor Frankl so beautifully explained, and it's so in line with what Judaism teaches us as well, that we have this unsatiable need in us, which we're all born with. The need, the depth of the need actually comes from the soul. The Baal Shem Tov used to talk about it. He used to say, there's a verse that says that people are hungry and their soul is in the hunger. And he asked, well, how can the soul be in the hunger? Hunger is a physical need. So he says that all hunger, in a broad sense, all hunger for physicality actually, even, is actually triggered by the soul. It's the soul wanting to live a life of purpose, wanting to elevate the physical world around us. But the soul, this is the complexity of life, the way we live it in this world. The soul cannot do that without the body, because we live in a physical world. How we achieve, this is the concept, right? How we achieve purpose and meaning, as we'll see later, how we achieve purpose and meaning in this world is in the physical world. It's not about detaching, it's about engaging. It's about elevating, it's about using the physical world around us for good purposes, for good meaning, for a life of a greater spiritual life and so on, right? Which is core to Judaism. We don't detach, we elevate, right? So the soul knows that in order to live a life of meaning, it needs the body. The body has to facilitate that journey of meaning. So the soul activates a hunger, a desire in the person to engage with the world. The problem is, if you don't know that the soul is doing that, you're not aware, then we just see it as a purely physical hunger. And we don't know what we're supposed to engage in, and why we're supposed to engage it in, and how we're supposed to engage. But we have this drive. Hunger is just a physical term. It's symbolic of every hunger. So what do? We activate in the hunger because there's this drive, this unsatiable drive to get things, to achieve things. But absence of the origin of that drive, which is the soul looking for meaning, we just fulfill our personal needs. And we engage in pleasure seeking, or empty pursuit, or as I heard today in a podcast, very nice line, exhibitionism, right? We not necessarily pleasure, but we do it because we want to create an image of success or whatever the case is. Right. And what does that do? It creates a very, very transient fix, very temporary fix. We feel good temporarily, and then a minute later, or a day later, or a week later, we're hungry again, And we have this emptiness again. Why? Because the need wasn't fulfilled. It came from the soul and it wasn't addressed. Does that make sense? Yeah. And that's why she talks about this process of always like questioning herself, like, why are we doing things? What's the basis of it? You know, she talks about in her own career where she had this unsatiable desire to be successful. She was working for companies, and at the end what happened was she said, well, maybe it's the drive to be even more successful, so she started her own company. Which isn't a bad thing to do necessarily, but it was for the wrong reasons maybe, right? And she hated it. She hated the whole journey. She thought it'd be amazing running a company. At the end, she described, I'm not going to go through the whole thing now. You could read it yourself if you want. But she describes how she really didn't like it. And she says that it was only when Yair, my husband, asked me one night, just before I went to bed, remind me, Michal, why are you starting this company? And I realized that I was on someone else's journey, not my own. She realized we're starting the company because that was the thing to do. That was a sign of success. That was a symbol in society of being a successful person, that not only you can work and be successful, but you can start your own company. Right? That was the basis. That was driving her, and it didn't work. So how do we do that? So how do we start the process? So in other words, the point is that therefore, it is clear. It's clear from Frankl's work. It's clear from understanding how this works, that not looking for purpose or not understanding that desire or that spark and that drive coming from the soul breeds unhappiness and breeds emptiness, really. So how do we start ourselves on a journey or increase or enhance, I should say, right? The journey for seeking purpose rather than self-benefit. So here's where she introduces this concept called bittul. Because what happens is as follows. What's clear is that when we are not aware of the soul, then our engagement with the world around us becomes one based on our ego. As we know, because it becomes animalistic, it becomes pleasure-seeking, it becomes selfish and self-serving, which is all an outcome of the ego, which we've talked about many times, that which the ego lives in the animal soul, right? Selflessness lives in the soul, godly soul, selfishness and egocentricity lives in the animal drives in the animal soul. So she discovers or talks about and starts to explain this concept of bittul, which is not just humility, it's a stronger word than humility, it's about leaving self. It's about dealing with our ego and eliminating it and
what language is bittul?
Bittul, it's Hebrew. Sorry, yeah, that was, yeah, it's a Yiddish, okay. It's a Yiddish format of the word, bittul, right? Like in yeshiva, when we learn these things, we call it, sorry, bittul, I should have said it, right? Does that make sense? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Levatel, like to cancel, right? It's like self-cancelization almost, right? Now, it's a very complex thing, right? It's complex because what does it mean to leave self? What does it mean to negate self? First, it's not a concept that most people are comfortable with. No one wants to lose self, right? Which is true. And the truth is that at the end of the day, God created us with skill sets. He created us with opportunities. He created us with abilities. He created us with talents. He created us with different personalities. And it actually wasn't designed ultimately that we should negate every part of ourselves. Right? So it can't be that at the end of the day, let's put it off here. It can't be that at the end of the day, bittul means becoming a robot. That's not what it means. That's obviously not what it means. But then the question is, what does it mean? And because it's such a complex idea, what does it mean to become really humble? Or what does it mean, really, this concept of self-negation in a positive sense, right? Which is a necessary step to move away from being self-serving and become one someone that looks for a life of purpose. We need to understand exactly what that means. And because it's so complex, often it's a little bit misunderstood. And sometimes people in dealing with the complexities of it, like, water it down a bit or misunderstand it just a little bit, which with all due respect to her, I think she actually did, but it doesn't matter. I mean, the model she describes is a good one too, but just for intellectual honesty, I want to explain it properly. and it makes a difference also of how we then seek purpose. But I want to give a little bit of an introduction. And here I'm sort of moving away into my own journey of learning, you know, when we learned an abundance of Hasidic philosophy in Yeshua and still do and so on. You know, part of my own learning schedule daily really includes learning Hasidic philosophy, right? And Hasidic philosophy is based on Kabbalah and it's very deep. And there's one thing that people, when they begin learning Hasidic philosophy, often struggle with. And that is that Hasidic philosophy often talks about levels and ideals that we're supposed to try and reach that seem completely unattainable. And they are unattainable, in its pure sense. And often people come up with the question of like, so why are we studying this? Like, I mean, maybe this is good for a 2% of the population that are on a very high spiritual level, but it's not for me, right? And yet we're encouraged to keep studying these ideas. Right? One of those ideas is bitul in a pure form, right? But I'm sharing with you because it's a very, very important concept. It's important in Judaism in general, but particularly in studying these concepts in deeper Hasidic philosophy. And the answer is as follows. Life is a journey, right? And not everyone is supposed to reach the same level in that journey. But the direction that Torah gives, and particularly in mysticism and Hasidic philosophy, is that we present you with the ultimate, we present you with the goalpost. Not intending that you always have to reach the goalpost completely, but you have to strive towards it. That's the idea. In other words, in two ways. First of all, you have to, and this is explained very, very often in certain passages of this type of study, where you have to, first of all, develop a mindset, at least in your mind, understand what that looks like. Will you be able to internalize it in its entirety? No, not necessarily. But knowing the undiluted goal, right? Knowing the undiluted goal helps you, motivates you, should the design to trigger a greater enthusiasm to inch a little bit more towards that goal. Am I making sense? And wherever possible to live your life by implementing the philosophy behind that goal, even though you might not reach it completely. I'll give you an example. It's not a recession, it's just so we... And because, you know, because they tell stories. When I was in Shiva at Fabrengas, we'd hear these stories often about great Hasidim who were learned very, very deep ideas. And they actually achieved great, great, great levels, but yet they were very humble and they were very, very self-aware. And they were very into not becoming arrogant. They were very, like, very focused on that. So there was a great, great Hasid, and then three, four generations away, his name was Reb David Horodoka. That was his name. He came from a town called Horodoka. And he was known, he was very steeped in the learning of Tanya, actually, particularly, where one of the things that discusses in Tanya is the intense prayer that a person should be able to achieve. And our prayer is an emotional connection with God, and it's a time to really cultivate real ahavat Hashem, love of God. And in Tanya, he describes what love of God means in ways that, if we're honest with ourselves, we read it properly, we're not quite there. Again, it's one of these goals that are, you know, can we say, I mean, even if someone says he loves God, you say he loves God like his child? No, like, you know, is an exclusive, absolute love of God? Simple people like us, probably not. You know, because we love God, but we also love the pizza too. So it's not quite, you know, there's room for other things too. You know, it's not exactly. But this Rav David Horodoka was known as, he was someone who like really, he had worked in himself and refined himself and he like loved God. You know what I'm saying? He like really achieved that level, or so it was seemingly. And on his deathbed, this is how the story goes. It's just a cute little story we used to get told in Yeshiva on his deathbed to bring out the point. Someone walked over to him in his last moments of his life and said, "Nu, Reb David, the Grecht Avas Hashem." In Yiddish, other words, he said, "Nu, Rabbi David, did you reach the level of love of God?" So he couldn't actually deny it because he actually had reached. He was one of the select few that had reached some of these levels. But he wouldn't agree either. He wouldn't confirm. He said, "No." So he said, "A kitzel gitan." He says, "No, it was a little tickle. To reach that level, of course not." What I'm trying to bring out is that honest people who learned these things would know that you don't have to reach it in order for it to be something that you engage in, right? So I'm just saying that in the context because we're going to talk about this concept of bittul. Real bittul, the way it's really explained in Hasidic philosophy, is a very high level to reach. But it's important to understand and be honest about what is it. And not to say, no, I can't understand it or I can't agree with it because I'm not going to reach it. It doesn't matter. It's a mindset that we read, and I'll explain why it's important to have that mindset. So she writes, going back to the book, and we'll sort of analyze as we go along. She writes that one of the most important lessons she learned is this concept of, she says it very nicely, she says that I learned from Jewish wisdom that feeding the ego, right, feeding the ego is the quickest way to starve the soul. Which is a very nice way of putting it, right? Because when we do things because they seem impressive or make us look successful, we are missing our chance to pursue our true purpose. We are focusing on the clipper, which is the concealment of the soul, rather than the divine energy in the soul. But when we stop looking at life as something we should always satisfy us, but instead focus on what we could do for others, we get closer to finding the meaning we were looking for all along. Jewish wisdom encourages us to look at our emptiness through a totally different lens. And look, she says something interesting here. And that see that what we feel as emptiness is not emptiness after all. It's actually a void that is being filled with the wrong things. That's an interesting idea. We're never actually empty. Even when we have that feeling of emptiness, unsettledness, we're not empty. We've just filled ourselves with the wrong things rather than the right things. The thing is, we've taken the wrong medicine, it's not doing the trick. Right? So therefore, she introduces this concept as bittul. Now, she talks about bittul meaning selflessness, and the word bittul means actually to nullify it, the thing, right? So she says, and this is the part where I'm going to disagree a little bit, she says what bittul isn't saying that you don't matter. It doesn't mean that a person's life's feelings and experiences aren't important. They most certainly are. Bittul teaches us that being full of yourself and caring only about yourself, obsessing over what you need to do and make yourself feel better all the time, that's the problem, right? That's what's getting in the way of a purposeful life. The idea of bittul is, this is what she says, it's a mindset shift from I am everything to I am not everything. That's actually incorrect. I'll tell you why. In other words, I can see what's happening here in the book. She's struggling with this bittul, right? I mean, it's hard to say that bittul would expect us to be nothing. Because after all, we're divinely created, right? So what? If I have a special talent in a particular area of life, it doesn't matter. My feelings don't matter. My personality doesn't matter. Right? So the way she deals with it is to try to create a balance approach to bittul. And that's why she says, it doesn't mean I'm not... It means I must shift from I'm everything, although everything is about me, to everything's not about me, but a little bit me too. Right? And that's a nice formula and it kind of works, but it's not actually what bittul really means. And I want to just explain what bittul means because it's an important concept to really understand what true growth is all about. Right? And the depth of what Judaism really contributes to the process of growth, which is perhaps an addition to... I mean, you know, often we talk about modern-day self-help concepts that are... were found in Jewish wisdom 2,000 years ago, right? We've done that a lot, yeah. But that's very nice. It's always beautiful to see that. But the truth is, as I said in the very beginning of the series, Judaism is not just another self-help book. It's a whole nother depth, right? So let me explain to you what bittul really is in a nutshell. I mean, this is a discussion for a long time. But bittul actually does mean complete nothingness. But it means complete nothingness and it means complete everythingness. And let me explain what I mean. The best way to explain it is to share with you something I once shared with you about Pesach. Don't want to scare anyone, but it is coming up. Right? Pesach in a couple of months. And the festival of Shavuot, which comes 7 weeks later. So we know that in we've talked about this many times, and this has directly connected with this concept of bittul, where Pesach, we're not allowed to eat any chametz, any risen bread, right? Fermented bread, whatever. And the idea of Pesach is that even a drop of chametz is no good, it's a terrible thing, it's a negative thing, only matzah, and so on and so forth. And we know that the concept of matzah is this idea of bittul. It's that idea of leaving our ego behind, eradicating the ego, right? And here, the Torah tells us a fascinating thing, that ego is not just something you have to minimize, really, ideally, ego is something you have to eradicate. If you want to go out of Mitzrayim, if you want to really go out of yourself, if you want to leave yourself behind and free yourself from yourself, if you keep hanging on to yourself even a little bit, it's not going to work. You might do a bit better, you might improve, you might have some meaning, but ultimately, you're still trapped in who you are. You haven't surrendered to something completely higher. And therefore, the Torah tells us that even a little bit of chametz is really bad, and therefore you should get rid of the whole thing. I'm in a real Hasidic mood today, so I'll tell you a nice little story. I mean, hopefully I'm always in a Hasidic mood, but today I'm reminiscing on stories that we were told in Yeshiva at Fabrengen's when we say a little bit of Chaim. So this is one of the classic stories we used to get told about letting go of ego. It's a good shtetl story. It's the kind of story you only tell by like a Hasidic Fabrengen. Because like it's a silly story, but it brings out a huge point. So the story goes like this, that in a shtetl, they once built, they always used to go horse and wagon. And then they introduced the train. It was the invention of the train. And there was this little shtetl that didn't have a train. And one day, headline news in shul, everyone, oh, did you hear the news? They're bringing tracks and they're building a train. So one little simple shtetl yid, he says to his friends, what's a train? He says, don't you know a train? Haven't you heard? A train is this unbelievable thing. You don't need a horse anymore. There's this thing called a locomotive in the engine in the front. It produces steam. It's got carriages behind and no horse. This thing pulls the bag. It says impossible. No such thing. He knows to get from place A to place B. You need a ferret, as they call it. You need a horse. A ferret, a horse. He says, listen, I don't know what to tell you. This is the fact. I'm not sure how it works, but this is a fact. Anyway, he says, okay, I've got to see it for myself. One day, finally, the first train pulls into town. The whole town comes to see it. It's a big simcha, including this yid and his friend. So he pulls in, and this guy's looking. No horse. Whew. So he says, oh, look, I showed you. He says, let me show you. This is now I understand what it is. I also read about it, but now I get it. Look, I'll show you. This is the machine, the engine in the front, the locomotive, whatever. And here are all the carriages. The guy's looking at some. It's amazing. A couple of minutes later, the guy who explained it to the simple Jew, he sees his friend looking, going close. He's looking underneath. He's looking at the side. He's looking on top. He's looking inside, outside. He's looking all around. So he says, "Was suchst du? What are you looking for?" He says, "There must be at least a kleiner Pferdl, at least a small horse somewhere. I'm looking for the small horse." Right. So we used to get told the story about, you know, sometimes we try to go behind us. You know, we try not be self-centered, and we maybe work on our ego. But are we really ready to, like, but there's still we want to hang on to the small horse. Like, we're not prepared to give up the horse completely. You know what I'm saying? Like, no. But yeah, okay, understand, I'll listen to someone else, I'll surrender to a higher purpose. But as long as I can still be me, right? A kleiner Pferd, a small horse. There still needs to be a small horse. So here comes the Torah and says, matzah, boom. You have to leave yourself completely. Total nullification, total bitul, as we call it, right? And then a funny thing happens. I've said this before, but in this context, it's important to understand how this works. 7 weeks later, on the festival of Shavuot, in the temple, there was a sacrifice that was brought. It was called Shtei Halechem, two breads. It was an animal brought, a sacrifice special for Shavuot, because, you know, from Pesach to Shavuot is a 7-week refinement process. It's called the Omer. And then on Shavuot, there was this sacrifice that was brought that had to be chametz. Not only could it be, but it had to be. So I don't know what happened all of a sudden. Ego, chametz is a symbol of ego because it rises that sense of self, right? 6-7 weeks later, it was a terrible thing. It was called egocentric. Even the small horse you got to get hold of, not one drop of chametz. And now suddenly, 7 weeks later, you must have chametz. What's going on here? And the answer is very simple. The answer is actually that stage one in real growth is real bittul. Not that I'm not everything, I'm nothing. Why am I nothing? Oh, this is the point. So nothing seems like a very negative thing. What do you mean I'm nothing? My nothing means because the way arrogance means I am something independently. My talents are my greatness. My successes are my successes. My accomplishments are my accomplishments. Right? The first step to getting rid of that is actually to a reset button. The reset button is to achieve a level, at least in our mind. I'm not saying we can, that's what I've said before, I'm not sure we could do this, but at least have the mindset, actually, I'm completely nothing. There's nothing of me that is mine and independent. Everything is God-given. Everything is dependent on God's energy. Everything that happens in the world is actually has no real existence without Him. Once you get to that, you know, there's a famous concept that when you plant a seed, in order to transition from a seed into a tree, the seed actually has to decompose and become nothing. That's another Hasidic concept. It's called Yesh Leyesh Ayin Be'emsa. From to go to one entity to another entity, you need nothingness in between. Because then God says to you're not nothing in the sense where you don't exist. Of course you exist. But then what you do is through the Omer, you reintroduce the self in the context of that nothingness. In that context of you don't really have anything independent about you. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't use who you are. It doesn't mean you should become a nothing. No, on the contrary. You need to use your brain because God gave you a brain. It's a God-given brain. Don't be arrogant because you succeeded it, because it's a God-given thing. Why are you arrogant? It's not yours, it's it, right? God gave you talents, use it. God gave you resources, use it. God gave you a specific type of personality which is unique, use it. If you've gone through the process where you actually completely self-negate as a you, but complete nothingness, then you are able then to enter and to surrender into a complete existence. But an existence as part of a completely something different, part of something higher, part of a godly existence. You get that? Right? That's real bittul. It's not like partial getting of myself. No, real bittul is actually complete letting go of ourselves. To then, my grandfather, not the grandfather I always talk about, my other grandfather, interesting enough, was a very deep Hasidic philosopher. He lives in Israel. And he was a very humble person. I don't know him that well. I've heard a lot about him. He was very famous in the Chabad circles in Israel at the time. He once traveled to the Rebbe, was a Purim. And he was pretty, he walked over to the Rebbe, it was the early years, and he cried and he said, actually, you know, even though he was a really great intellectual and Hasidic philosopher, he said, I'm asking the Rebbe a bracha that I should have emunah, I should believe. In other words, he was more interested in believing than understanding, because he says, you know, I don't really understand. He says, I've learned a lot, I don't understand anything. And the Rebbe turned to him and said, no. Farshtayin dafman, you have to understand. But you don't have to want to understand. Meaning, you have to understand because that's part of the purpose. God gave you a brain, you have to use it. But not as a self-serving thing, not because you need to understand. In other words, the exchange between him and the Rebbe translated was, he was saying to the Rebbe, I want matzah. And the Rebbe was saying to him, no, but you got to get to Shavuot. Follow? In other words, he says, my understanding is nothing. It's all about me and I don't want to understand. I don't understand anyway. He was trying to exercise bitterly. He says, just give me a blessing. I should at least believe. And the Rebbe said, yes, that's true. But then you have to get the understanding also, because there's a you that is important. It's not an independent you. It's not an arrogant you. It's now a bitul you. But it's a you that is part of a much greater being. It's part of an infinite being of God, which you have to use. God wants you to use it. There's a purpose in it. Part of your purpose, part of your journey is to use the things that God has given you, every part of your being. But not for selfish reasons, for selfless reasons. Right? Now again, to reach this in its entirety is very lofty, but it's the mindset. Right? Okay, running out of time. No, I'm not going to go to the third thing this week. I'll come to the third thing next week of what purpose actually looks like. But I'll just emphasize this and clarify it by a story which I've shared with you a long, long time ago. But again, she interprets it as a more of a balance, and I don't think it's quite properly understood. So it was a famous Hasidic Rebbe. His name was Reb Simcha Bunim of Pshischa. And Reb Simcha Bunim of Pshischa said that he has two pockets. In those two pockets, each pocket has a note. I don't know if you remember this. I told you this a while ago. And the two notes are two quotes from the Talmud. One is from the Chumash, actually. One note it said was a note of humility. It was a quote from Avraham Avinu, who came to God to try and defend the city of Sodom. And he said to God, I hope you don't mind, but Anochi afar ve'efer, I'm nothing, I'm dust. I'm dust and ashes, I'm just nothing. Right? But nevertheless, I know I'm nothing, but I'm asking you anyways to please save Sodom, right? Okay. That's the one quote. And the other quote, in the other pocket, is Bishvili nivra ha'olam. That the Talmud says a person should say, the world was created for me. And the Pesach Rebbe says, in order to keep myself focused, I carry those two notes in my two different pockets. And I guess the idea was, once in a while, I look at each one and I bring them together. So the question is, how does it come together? Anochi afar va'efer, I am dust and ashes, seems like the ultimate bitul. Right? And then, Bishvili nivra olam, the world is created for me, sounds like the ultimate arrogance. Right? The world is created for me, what do you mean? It's about me? No. So, in the context, the way she explains the bitul in the book is that is that it's a balance. You have to have a balance, right? But that's not what it means. It's not about balance. The two things actually go hand in hand beautifully together. And it's not because it's a balance. It's not a bit of both. Not at all. It's exactly the concept I said before about Matzah and Shavuot. In other words, Anochi Afar Va'efer means that as an independent being, as a self-accomplished being, I'm actually nothing. I'm a speck on the existence. In the bigger scheme of things, this world is very limited. This world is finite. This world is just... In the context of God's infinity, this world is really nothing. It's a very weak existence. It's something that is totally dependent on God's creation, as the Alter Rebbe explains in Tanya, the greatest stage. It's totally, if it wouldn't be, as the Baal Shem Tov explained, if God wouldn't continuously create the world, we would actually return to nothingness. So the world actually is nothing. If I'm looking at the world as an independent, separate existence outside of the infinite reality of God. But once I get to that point, so who am I? If I'm nothing, I exist, right? So who am I? If I'm truly dust and ashes? Oh, I'm nothing if I look at myself as standalone. But if I'm part of God's existence, if I'm part of His world, I'm part of His reality, I'm infinite. Not only I'm infinite, I'm here for a purpose. And my purpose has to be expressed in a way that maybe someone else can't express it, because each person has their own mission. And we're going to talk about this next week in much greater depth. What does it mean to have a unique purpose? What does that mean? And I need to get up in the morning and say, I matter. Not I matter as a self-centered thing, because Anochi Afar Va'efer, I'm dust, I'm nothing. But actually, I matter more now. Because if my existence, if my presence is actually now part of a much greater infinite reality, it's part of God's reality, boy, do I matter. What I do really makes a difference. So bishvilin ivra olam, I have to get up and get going and be responsible. And don't say someone else is going to do it for me. Because no, what you can do, someone else can't do. Because if God put you and the other person here in this world, it's because you have one part of the purpose to fulfill, the other person has a different part of the purpose to fulfill. And what you can fulfill, no one else can do. No one else can do what? Not to be self-serving and pleasure-seeking. No one else can achieve your purpose. God's purpose. The reason why God created the world and put you here. No one else can achieve what you need to accomplish. So I'm riding on that reality now. I've introduced my every part of me in the context of the matzah, in the context of the ultimate bitul. So therefore, the talents, the personality, the abilities that God gave me are actually infinite. They're part of His reality. The potential is great, and my mission is important. So let me get up. Let me say, "Bishulin nivra alam." No one's going to do what I can do, because the world was created for me. Meaning, my world was created for me because I need to accomplish a purpose. If I was just arrogant and it was all about me, so today I'm in the mood. Tomorrow I'm not in the mood. It's precisely because there is bitul, because I'm nothing. So who am I? Oh, part of God's reality. Oh, then I can't. It's not today I'm in the mood, tomorrow I'm not in the mood. Every day has a mission. Every day has a purpose. The world was created for me. My purpose today is really critical and important. So the world was created for me. I better get up and get going.
So do you think there's daily purposes?
There's daily purposes. There's life purposes. But you know, we're going to go into that much more. The whole concept of purpose and how one finds, that's what we'll go into tomorrow. Because this, I wanted to share this with you, this real interpretation of Bittul, not because only for intellectual honesty, but I also wanted to do it because actually it makes a little bit of a difference of how we then approach purpose, approach looking for purpose, which we'll examine next week. So have a wonderful day and a wonderful week.